You're listening to History Out Loud, Chat from the Stacks, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries. Presented by Jill Carpenter. Here we are for another episode. I say we, it's just me, Jill, with two guests, History Out Loud Black Belts, John Billingsley and Paul Weatherhead. Welcome back, both.
Hi, both.
For any new listeners, I'll just say a little bit about them. John is a writer, a folklorist, and editor of Northern Earth magazine. And Paul is also a writer. Would you say folklorist, Paul?
I'm happy with that, I guess, yeah. weird historian, maybe.
Weird historian. Musician and songwriter and teacher. So yeah, you're both quite similar in some ways in your interests, but I would say maybe coming at it from a slightly different angle. What do you think?
I think we constitute a Venn diagram.
Right, okay.
Yeah, there's definitely an intersection.
Yeah, there's an intersection in the middle. Yeah,
that's right. A very close intersection in the middle of things.
Yeah. Well, today's Venn diagram is Robin Hood. That's what we're going to talk about. More specifically, his death and the mysterious goings on thereafter. So first off, I wanted to ask, because until now, I would say my Robin Hood points of reference have been Michael Praed and Kevin Costner. Do we know, was there really such a person as Robin Hood? Did he exist? I'll start with John.
No. I think it's safe to say there was probably no Robin Hood ever, but there may have been very many contributors to the legend. One of them may have had a name which became bowdlerized into Robin Hood. In the 13th century, Robin Hood became a surname in the south of England. So that was evidently in response to legends that were going around. And Robin Hood also became a kind of a nickname for existing outlaws and robbers. So they would just adopt his name. So you've got two things going on there, which suggests a kind of mass dissemination of Robin Hood. And the whole search for an actual historical Robin Hood is fruitless. It's an attempt, in most cases, in my view, to try to grab a big legend and pull it into your own small world. You know, it's an incorporation for the sake of your community, is a way of saying, he's ours. When, of course, the surnames in the south of England in the 13th century, the northern ballads, because it's a northern story type, throughout the medieval period, indicates that his character is applied over a wide range of individuals. Mm. And then when in 16th century, when he gets incorporated into May games as well, that adds another aspect of a potential Robin Hood. So historical Robin Hood? Nah, not for me. What do you think, Paul?
I agree. I think trying to find the Robin Hood, maybe it's a bit like looking for the King Arthur. There's so many contributing factors to the legends I think I agree with John. It's a fruitless search. I mean, there were people called Robin Hood, and there may have been people called Robin Hood who were bandits or outlaws, but was there the Robin Hood? No, I don't think so. Hmm. I think it's much bigger than that.
Paul mentions King Arthur there, which is very relevant to the idea of multiple personalities and multiple locations. And it's something that we might find ourselves returning to, I think.
Mm, yeah. What I was going to ask was, could Robin Hood be a folk character that's adapted from something like the Green Man?
The Green Man's associated, and the Green Knight, of course, and Robin Braid and so on. All these have a kind of magical association, a kind of pagan association, which, if there was but any particular magical side to Robin Hood, you would expect it to appear in the ballads, and they just don't. It's overinterpretation from the 1970s onwards, I think I'd say. There are elements. The most magical element in all of the ballads that I've read is the woman or women in the death of Robin Hood, the ones who are banning him at the bridge, because you get clear parallels with Shakespeare's Macbeth. And the surviving bit of the manuscript talks about one woman banning him, but her words are given as we, which is why if I tell the story, I tend to throw three in, because it would seem to be appropriate. That's the only magical bit. For the rest of it, he's a rambunctious, slashing, hacking, fighting bloke. So he's very much down to earth.
Could you just say a couple of words about banning? Because people might not know what banning is.
Yeah, nobody really knows what it means in this context. Lamenting is one, a simplest interpretation. Another interpretation might be as a kind of curse or a kind of prophecy, because you put up the banns before a wedding, which is a statement of a future event. So hence banning Robin could be the statement, what she says, you'll go there and you'll not come back again. And he doesn't come back again. So banning has this general sense of prophecy. And the other side of magical Robin Hood is that much of his exploits take place in liminal locations. So although he's not magical, he's still somebody on the edge. He's an outlaw. He's between, for instance, the rich and the poor. You know, he can abduct you from the highway, from this world, take you into the Greenwood, which becomes an alternative world. And it's out of this liminality, I think, that the magical subtext has grown.
Mm.
But you've got to be careful with it, I think. Or I don't even have any comments on that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think confusing Robin Hood with magic is largely an over-interpretation. And I agree that adventure, meeting the woman or women by the black water, and the curse or the lament, that seems to be one of the few magical bits that, or parts of the story that hints at some kind of magic that I can remember seeing in any of the ballads.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the ballads? Am I right in saying originate from the 15th century, or is it before then?
Before that. Mm. It's the 14th century that we know. The jest is, if I've got it right, help me out on that. Is it 14th century, late 14th century it's reckoned to be?
I think it is, because the jest, that's the one that's in the Percy Folio, and that's a collection of ballads doing the rounds in the 17th century, and some of the ballads that were collected there go back to the 12th. So the 14th sounds about right, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's reckoned to have been in existence before being written down, at least a century before. So what we're looking at is stories which grew up in the medieval period and then began to be written down in the late medieval period. And then they began to change character in the Tudor era.
So the early ones have him in Barnsdale Forest, South Yorkshire. You mention in your book, John, the rivalry between Sherwood and Barnsdale, and Yorkshire and Nottingham. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
There are social and economic issues involved in all of this. In the hinterland of Robin Hood, we might say, which includes Sherwood, includes Barnsdale, Nottingham was the biggest city. So if you're a storyteller, you're going to be drawn to Nottingham. And as one thing storyteller knows, that if you can localize your story, it tends to increase the cash you get afterwards. You know, it's an economic thing. Involve the audience in your story and they're more generous. So there's that element in it, which will tend to mean that as the travel and the market increased, Sherwood will increase in importance rather than Barnsdale, because Barnsdale is decreasing. But the two forests are between 6 and 12 miles separate. And there's a story of Richard III, I think it was, pursuing a deer, going hunting from Sherwood into Barnsdale. So it's not very far.
Presumably on horseback.
Presumably, yeah. There'll be no problem for a bunch of outlaws to move between the two. And if you think about it, there are also stories that Robin Hood decamped to Robin Hood's Bay in North Yorkshire when he thought things were getting a bit hot in more western areas. So outlaws are fluid and their locations need to be fluid. But the earliest mentions are Yorkshire. And it's generally agreed by scholars, but not by the civic authorities of Nottingham, that Robin Hood is the Yorkshireman. Yeah.
Do we have any statues in Yorkshire?
There's a statue in Robin Hood Airport in near Doncaster.
Ah.
So, you know, a little bit of Yorkshire laying claim to the legend there.
Yeah. We were
no robbed. Nottingham people have attacked it yet.
Yeah.
But against all that Sherwood Barnsdale thing, there is this curious eruption of Robin Hood as a surname in the south of England in the 13th century, which, you know, it confuses the issue in a fascinating sort of way, because it does throw everything open. How far back do these stories go? And it also underlines something else about the whole Robin Hood and the ballads issues. So many twists and turns within the stories. When I was doing my writing on it, it was hard to kind of keep a coherent thread going through the stories. There's always something to throw you off the track. And part of that is because there's so much variation in dates of the ballads. He's an elusive figure.
I think you can definitely say it's very elusive, and it's quite hard to put your finger on all kinds of aspects. And I think that stretches from the ballads, the setting, the nature of Robin Hood, and then all the crazy stuff that started happening when we get to the 20th century as well.
Yeah, good point.
Can we just go through the story of what happened to Robin Hood, his final journey and his death? Do you want to take that, John?
Yeah, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
Towards the end of one winter in the Greenwood, and one of the points you have to remember that living in the Greenwood is not a comfortable life. You get aches and pains. Anybody in Yorkshire knows that. Living outdoors is even worse. So towards the end of winter, you're beginning to get a bit sluggish, a bit achy, and what you basically need is a detox. And the detox that was available back in those days was having your blood let by a physician. Blood let just meant that some of your blood was run off, allowing it to refresh itself. So Robin decides that his cousin, the prioress of Kirklees, was a skilled physician and she'd be good for it. So he announces to his men that he was going off to see his cousin to be bled. Real scarlet pops up then and said, Robin, do you think that's a good idea? Because, you know, a lot of the targets of our robbing have been priories and abbeys. And also it said that the prioress has a lover, Roger of Doncaster, and we've taken money off him. So it might not be the best thing to go just you and Little John to Kirklees Priory. We think you should take a good few of us with you. And Robin gets a bit uppity about this and he says, you know, no, she's my cousin. Family stands for a lot in my world. And I'll be safe with her and with Little John. Little John is associated with Clifton upon Calder. So Little John would like to go to his home and two of us will be fine. So off they headed. And they met the old lady or ladies at the bridge. And Robin just brushes her off as well. And eventually they come to the priory and Robin knocks on the door. Being a man, he's not admitted into the priory, but he is taken into the gatehouse. Speaks with his cousin and she lays him on the treatment bed. Fixes up the bleeding irons and says, like any good doctor, you just lie there and rest. I'll be back in a while. So Robin lies there and he rests and he thinks about this and thinks about that. And after a while, he begins to realise he's feeling a bit drowsy. And he takes a look at the bowl, which is catching his blood. And it's already beginning to overflow. And the ballads say, first the blood ran thick and red, and then it ran thin and white. And he's being bled dry. And he realised that, just as Will Scarlett had said, he was being betrayed. So he reaches for his horn and he blows his horn. But this is not going to be the Robin Hood blowing his horn that you know from the Richard Green episodes. It's not... It's more like... Hearing that, Little John knows something's wrong. He rushes into the gatehouse, and you can imagine this kind of Hollywood scene at this point, kicking doors aside or whatever, rushes up to the bed, and he sees Robin lying there, obviously dying. Robin's accepted this by that time. And Little John says, I will raise this priory to the ground. He says, no, John, I've never hurt woman yet, and I never shall now. Just hand my bow. And at this point, the oldest ballad says, Robin Hood tells Little John, just bury me by the highway side, reaffirming his highway connection. And John does that. And that's the end of the story, according to the first ballad. But the later ballad then adds the arrow legends, whereby he fires an arrow from the window and asks Little John to bury him where it lands.
Can we say something about Kirklees Priory? It's just inside Calderdale, midway between Brighouse, as we know it, and Merfield. It was founded in the 12th century under the reign of Henry II and was occupied by Cistercian nuns. Have I pronounced it right?
Yeah.
Cistercian. For 400 years before finally being dissolved by Henry VIII in 1539. So it's quite an interesting place, isn't it, the priory? It had a bit of folklore surrounding it itself about the nuns.
But yeah, the nuns had a certain reputation. So there were rumours and there are records of the nuns doing things that they shouldn't have been doing, altering their habits, whether that means showing a bit of leg, I'm not quite sure, but meeting men, which again they shouldn't have been doing. And there are records of them being punished or forgiven for various activities. And of course, many of these young women wouldn't have been nuns by vocation. They may have just been unwanted daughters that were offloaded to the prioress. So there is that side of Kirklees Priory that also makes it interesting. I mean, it was there for 400 years, so that's quite an achievement for that organisation to be going for so long.
Do you think it was similar situation to, say, like the Magdalene laundries in Ireland? They just took in girls that were deemed difficult or that, like you say, unwanted, and that really, yes, they weren't natural nuns, as it were. They were confined, basically.
I think the Kirklees nun's vocation might not have been the vocation you normally have in mind. Yes, when the priory was dissolved, three of them went off to found the three nuns in the hostelry there. So, I mean, this was an obvious extension of skills, because abbots and priories were places of hospitality anyway, although not usually quite so extreme hospitality as the nuns showed on occasion. They knew how to feed people with beer and entertain them in other ways, quite clearly. One of the nuns, for the three nuns, then got pregnant. It was said, quite possibly by one of King Henry's dissolution officials. Whether it's dissolution that we're talking or dissoluteness, I'm not sure, but she drowned herself in the Nun Brook, it said. So, but as Paul says, it maintained itself. The idea of Magdalene laundries, that's never occurred to me, but it's an interesting thought. There's also the story of Adam of Copley finding a wife from amongst the Kirklees nuns as well.
Oh, yes, I remember reading that in your book. Yeah.
And eloping with her, basically, keeping her secret.
I suppose there's also that the certainly in Shakespeare's time, nunnery was another way of talking about brothels. And so you just wonder what kind of connection there was with the kind of activities going on in Kirklees. You know, there's a scene in Hamlet where it says, "Hie thee to a nunnery," but it's sort of suggested that it is implying a brothel there. So I don't know if we could go as far as to say that's what was happening at Kirklees, but as John was saying, that they were associated with hospitality, speaking very broadly.
So the gatehouse where Robin Hood met his end is the only surviving building of Kirklees Priory. It's a Grade II listed timber frame building from the early 16th century. So there must have been one prior to that.
There must have been, yeah. There must have been, and we don't know what it looked like. If you'd have gone there any time since 16th century, there was always a room that in the current building, which is pointed out as where Robin met his end. It's a very romantic building. It's timber framed. It's very oldie worldy. But I've been in the building. I've wandered around it, and I stood at the window facing the general direction of Robin Hood's grave, and realised that you could not fire a straight arrow to the grave from there. So the room, which is normally pointed out as the room of Robin Hood's demise, doesn't work. It would need to be on the other side if we were talking about a building which had the same floor plan as the current gatehouse, which is unlikely anyway.
Mm.
Paul, you were telling me something about a chap who's done some experiments with a bow and arrow from the gatehouse.
Yeah, I think it was an ITV news item where a historian called Richard Rutherford Moore attempted to shoot an arrow from the gatehouse to Robin Hood's grave, and it was impossible for a normal human to get an arrow that far. And I think he used a sort of a vaguely historically accurate version of a bow and arrow. Does that mean sort of Robin Hood has something of the superhero about him, the sort of almost supernatural strength? But yeah, so that was the attempt to reconstruct that legendary event, and it didn't work.
We do, of course, have legends of Robin Hood having supernatural strength. He threw stones over the River Calder from the Sorby to Wainstalls and Midgley, for instance. Robin Hood's penny stone. He threw a huge stone 6 miles from Blackstone Edge to Monkstone Edge. And later folk legends do portray him as the giant. So there's a different thread appearing in the Robin Hood stories, which give him this superhuman strength. And of course, it talks him up as a great outlaw as well, to be able to fire an arrow, which we haven't mentioned yet, 575 yards from the gatehouse to where he currently stands. And if you can do that with little blood in the, you're pretty good. No archer was as he so good.
Yes.
There's several stories, isn't there, which all seem to sort of point to different places where he might have been buried, as well as the official one. There's one where he fires the arrow and he's just very weak and it only just plops over into the river.
Yeah, that's the story that was current in the Armitage family. They said he fired a couple. One landed in the Nunbrook, which runs alongside the Priory, and the other one lands in the big fish pond. Neither of which were very good, so he just tells King John, Little John. He just tells Little John to go and bury him by the highway, which could be a way of saying that actually the Armitage family, you know, wants to say he was put there by the highway for a particular reason.
Is that to keep them away from their land?
When was it the Armitages came into possession of the land? 1565.
They came into ownership of Kirklees estate and Robin Hood's grave.
Yeah, so things get murky around them. Was there even a grave there at that time, or was it just a legend? Was it a medieval grave, or was it placed there at the edge of the Armitage estate to try to keep people away, beside the highway? Subtext saying, look, Robin Hood's dead, he's not going to leap out in the bushes and waylay you. We don't really know what was going on there, but there are various possibilities. But certainly the grave was a statement that Robin Hood was no longer somebody to be reckoned with.
Hmm. So if we concentrate on the official grave that's there, it stands in woodland, 575 yards from the gatehouse. And it consists of a dilapidated iron cage on top of a surrounding wall enclosure. And it was built by the Armitage family in the 18th century. So I suppose the first question is, why was it enclosed?
If you go there, inside this cage, you'll see a fairly random lump of rock. And it is supposed that this might be all that's left of the gravestone, because when the canal was being built through the valley at the bottom of the hillside, the gravestone was being predated by the navvies there, who were Irish navvies, and they believed that the gravestone itself had certain healing properties, especially for toothache and headache. If you chipped a bit off the gravestone and put it under your pillow, it would help cure the toothache. It's a story you'll also hear told of Stonehenge. And so the idea is that Irish navvies, and we're getting into politics here again there, Irish navvies who were canal builders, you know, employed as canal builders, they were Roman Catholic, and they're treating it rather in a Catholic way of relics.
Oh, yeah.
Is like a saint's relic. Robin comes then, this fairly superhuman, supernatural figure, having healing powers. But yeah, it's also a way of othering the Irish navvies to a certain extent.
Could there be an idea that in terms of dentistry, which in those days you would just pull a tooth out that hurt. So that in a sense, in chipping away at a grave, you are somehow transferring that process. Metaphorically speaking, you're chipping at your teeth and that might somehow cause the pain to go away.
I don't know.
It's a bit of an outlier, but anyway.
My dentist doesn't use a chisel, I've got to say.
So, and yeah, to go back to that little stone, which we've, as we say, it's a random lump of rock. There's no trace of any inscription on it or anything like that. So whether it really is the remains of a gravestone or not, I'm suspicious, me.
Me too. I mean, there's the well-known Nathaniel Johnston sketch from 1665 that was later copied that shows an inscription on the stone that says, "Here lie Robert Hood, William Goldborough, Thomas." So three separate names. So that was supposedly no longer legible by the 18th century. So don't really know what to make of that, because there is a sketch, but it's a copy, and the other two mysterious names, along with Robert Hood, who knows?
Yeah, there's the copy of a copy, Nathaniel Johnson's sketch, I believe, if I'm right, the copy that's always reproduced was done by William Stukeley, who, while being a great antiquarian, was also a little bit loose in some of his scholarly rigour at times.
That's one way of putting it.
Yeah, well, you know, when you look at it's hard to see where he could have embellished on that thing, but whatever, is it the stone? Was it there? So it's again, it's this uncertainty abounds.
In your book, John, Hood, Head and Hag, you have a nice little story about somebody actually removing the gravestone.
Yeah, it's one of the it's one of these semi-supernatural stories that come to be associated latterly after the ballads with Robin Hood. A certain knight, almost definitely an Armitage, decided that the gravestone would look good in his hall. So he had it removed at great effort and dumped on his hearth. And he went to bed well satisfied with himself and came down in the morning, the stone had been moved. So he put it back, went through the day, went to bed at night, came back next morning, it had been moved back again. So he set it straight. Next morning he came down and it had been moved again. And at that point he realised that there was something strange afoot. So he ordered it to be replaced where it came from. And in replacing it to its original site, it only took half the number of oxen and horses that it had taken to bring it there. So it knew where it wanted to be, even if we don't actually know where that was.
Mm.
There's so many uncertainties about the whole grave. Some said the true grave is somewhere in the primary grounds itself, for instance. No particular evidence for that, and there's no particular evidence for anything.
Samuel Armitage had the grave dug into in 1706, didn't he?
That's right. Found nothing. Went down three feet, and found no evidence of the earth beneath it ever having been disturbed. So they gave up and said, "Nobody there."
There seem to be quite a few one too many stories associated with the grave, and that sort of it allows the believers in Robin Hood as a real figure and as a real outlaw who's buried there to sort of maintain that belief. If they can say, well, they didn't dig very deeply and they might have been a bit drunk, so it allows them to cling on to that belief of Robin Hood as the real hero. lying buried and neglected in the crumbling ruins of the grave.
Yeah, you should have dug deeper.
There's one thing we haven't mentioned about the gravestone, is that set into the enclosing wall is a rhyme.
Ah, yes. I've got it here.
Have you got it to hand?
I wrote it in the modern English. Well, it was in your book in the modern English. I didn't translate it to modern English, but it's here underneath this little stone lies Robert, Earl of Huntingdon. No archer was him so good, and people called him Robin Hood. Such outlaws as he and his men will England never see again.
I've got the...
You do the old original one, yeah.
Yeah. Bear in mind, I'm a Londoner and it needs kind of...
Get into character.
I'm not sure that I could do it, but it's quite clearly somebody attempting to put it into spurious dialect some centuries before. Here, underneath this little stean, lies Robert, Earl of Huntingdon, near Archer there as he sat good, and people called him Robin Hood. Sic outlaws as he and his men will England never see again. Albeit 24 calendar December 1247. Okay. I can't do that last bit. It's laughable the whole that anybody could ever have construed this as real is extraordinary, particularly as the actual date given in the Roman calendar does not exist. 24 calends?
Yeah.
The Roman calendar doesn't have any date that would accord with that. So it's obviously BS.
And I think because the idea of Robin Hood as a nobleman, the Earl, that was way later than that, wasn't it? That sort of derived from were the Elizabethan times or plays anyway that were written about at that time, Tudor times?
The Tudor time is when that started Robin advancing up the social ladders. Yeah, because this is also when the a whole bunch of politics starts entering into the whole outlaw legend generally, but Robin Hood most specifically. So that inscription, we may assume, was also concocted. It was done by an Armitage, but copied from an earlier rhyme, it said, but I'm not sure where that was from. Do you know, Paul?
No. It's clearly spurious, though, isn't it? I think we agree on that.
One thing I think we can mention while we're talking about the gatehouse and the grave, every year there's a kind of guided walk in the estate led by Calderdale Heritage Walks called Outlaws and Nuns. And that's about the only way for a member of the public to access the estate now. So I'd say look at the Calderdale Heritage Walks website, find out when it is and book a place, just to get a visual image of what we're talking about today.
You've been listening to History Out Loud, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries, produced and presented by Sarah Rose and Jill Carpenter. Join us next time when Paul, John and Jill will be discussing 20th century hauntings and vampire sightings at Robin Hood's grave.